From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, we'll talk about Russia's role in the Syria conundrum with our foreign policy contributor. Then chalk up another problem with sleep deprivation. It makes us eat more.
This is just another example of a very sophisticated process that is designed to keep us from starving that in 21st century America is getting all out of whack and is really pushing us to gain weight.
Dave Lurson previews what's coming to a movie theater near you and why Detroit might be worth a road trip this fall.
There's all kinds of great things happening in Detroit, but much of the media finds the good bits, shall we say, inconvenient.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's nice to have you listening today. It has been a roller coaster week for U.S. policy towards Syria. When the week opened, the Obama administration was engaged in a full-court press with members of Congress trying to build support for U.S. military action against the Assad regime. Now, as the week closes, Russian President Vladimir Putin has floated a plan to put Syria's chemical weapons cache under international control. And President Obama gave a televised speech in which he both defended the need for military action and also urged Congress to wait on a vote so the Russian plan could be pursued. Art Sear of Carthage College is our foreign policy contributor. He's with us now to help make sense of what's happening. Nice to have you back.
Well, thank you much.
What do you make of this latest twist to the saga of Syria, the Russian proposal to bring Syria's stock of chemical weapons under international control?
I think it's a very shrewd move. It's amazing, isn't it? I think President Putin may well be a serious contender for a Nobel Peace Prize if this initiative and momentum keeps up. He certainly should receive an Academy Award, maybe a Super Bowl ring, given Russia's limited...
I think he already has a Super Bowl ring, right?
Given Russia's, in objective terms, very limited resources. They have nuclear weapons, but they don't mean as much as they used to. They're actually a very weak economy, except for oil. And given his background as a KGB lifer and pro, bluntly a very brutal man, as well as a very smart man, it's remarkable that he's been able to leverage the current situation into effectively world leadership.
Well, is there any way we can know for certain the motivations behind this offer?
I think the motivations are self-interest. I think serious people listen to NPR. George Kennan, K-E-N-N-A-N, who had Milwaukee roots, a principal definer and planner of U.S. policy during World War II when he was very young and for many years afterwards. He's one of the most perceptive analysts of Russia. He was obsessed with Russia, in love with Russia, afraid of Russia and the Soviet Union. And he emphasized continuity in terms of the way Russians pre-communist have approached the world, and caution in the use of force, constant disciplined focus on self-interest because they were weaker than other European great powers has really defined Russia and the Soviet Union and now Russia again. And I think Putin's operating in line with that tradition.
There are a number of lines of analysis about this move by Putin and the Russians. One is that they would not even be taking this role if it weren't for the threat that the U.S. might unilaterally take military action. And at the same time, there's another line of analysis that goes, the Russians give the Obama administration great cover to drop their call for military action unilaterally. Can both of those things be right?
In theory, in practice, I think the latter is right. There is a palpable sense of relief in the White House and especially in the always turbulent and unpredictable hallways of Congress, both houses, that we may be off the hook on this. I don't believe the first is really plausible. The president especially has been trumpeting this, including in his address to the nation Tuesday night. But while we have been threatening military action, we've now been threatening it for a long time, which means we lost the initiative and Putin grabbed the ball. Also, the president reiterated more and more and more that this would be a very limited strike, you know, very focused, in a sense, very tactical, which means that Assad and Putin and others involved, I think were less and less concerned over time. It not only would not, in any strategic sense, destroy their assets, but also were giving them an enormous amount of time to insulate themselves from whatever cruise missiles might be targeted at.
Vladimir Putin authored an opinion piece in the New York Times on Thursday, just another feather in his cap, building up his portfolio in case he, you know, has to apply for journalism jobs later. He urged the U.S. to back off its threat of using military force. Could you make the argument that, really the U.S. already has?
Yes, I think that's right. And again, it's permitted him to seize the initiative. Successful politicians don't, of necessity, confuse rhetoric and talk with action. We professors are often quite guilty of that for understandable reasons. We sit in our offices and decide what people should do, and then we open the door and we tell the world what it should do, and we're surprised when people don't immediately applaud. If you get to the top in politics, you've had to broker interests, you've had to reconcile interests, and you've had to get things done. President Obama has gone a remarkably long way in a very short period of time. And he's also our chief executive. I mean, no disrespect at all, but one has the sense that there is sort of the academic weakness. I've made a speech. I've gotten applause. Therefore, it will happen. But not much has actually happened in the past 5 years. And this is in foreign policy coming home to roost.
Well, and you could make the argument that the Obama administration was really in need of an out for this, given the amount of isolation that, you know, between Vladimir Putin's worldwide PR maneuvering, opposition to military force by many in the American public, much of the U.S. Congress, and even our allies in Britain. There was not a lot of support this administration had short of Senator McCain.
That's a fair point. And even McCain, Congress is like an opera. Everybody has an opinion, often expressed at great length. Even McCain had reservations and permutations and corrections and connections he wanted to put into any resolution. So, in fact, Congress ever passes anything, it's going to be a Rube Goldberg device with all kinds of impractical additions, which underscores the point again. If you're going to use military force, you should use it very quickly and as ruthlessly as possible.
There's also an interesting contradiction at work here, given the opposition by a majority of the American public to military action in Syria. At the same time, it's difficult to imagine if a majority of Americans would support the Russian president telling Americans what to do or think.
Oh, I think that's true. On the other hand, having mentioned George Kennan and continuity, the PR skill that the Kremlin is currently exercising does represent progress. Dictatorships, whether of the old-fashioned totalitarian variety or the traditional variety, they tend to be very heavy-handed in their public relations, partly because the guys at the top have to listen, only have to listen to themselves if they're around for a while. I think the Kremlin, collectively, and Putin at the top, they've developed considerable skill in the always demanding, always sophisticated U.S. media market. Whatever we are in this great country, we're not a dictatorship. And we benefit long term. They're becoming much more cosmopolitan and much more worldly at dealing with the rest of the globe. It's quite remarkable, very impressive, especially given a secret police background. This is not your typical KGB guy.
This is a KGB guy with some insight into how Twitter works.
Exactly. Or at least people around him. He's very well advised. He picks good younger people. He's a great survivor. Obviously, he also operated in Eastern Europe, which is worth mentioning. John le Carré, who spent some time in British intelligence before he became someone who kind of now defines intelligence work of the skillful British variety for everybody else. His earliest and best work was focused on Central Europe, Germany, and in particular Berlin. The Russians hired a lot of ex-Nazis. Who weren't necessarily skillful intelligence operatives, but they were challenging colleagues. And that dynamic meant that East German intelligence turned out to be particularly brutal, particularly insightful and ruthless. The East German spy apparatus had several great coups in dealing with West Germany during the Cold War. And that's something I just thought of as we're talking, but it's extremely important to pursue further in understanding the current dynamic.
Well, and it's interesting because we are still probably a generation away from leadership in that part of the world that will not have emerged from an Eastern Bloc mentality. There will be a generation before too long that was not alive or was certainly very young when the Berlin Wall fell.
Absolutely. And that applies to both sides of what used to be the Iron Curtain. We're now rapidly approaching a time when very few members of Congress or the executive branch will have any experience directly with war. Every U.S. president from Harry Truman to George Herbert Walker Bush, whom we were discussing off the air, served in the military. Truman, Bush, and also Kennedy. And as far as we're concerned, Eisenhower, we're all combat veterans. Starting with Clinton, I think there is a detectable lack of insight, lack of skill, and sort of casual approach to military affairs that can hurt us and has hurt us.
One of the things that we have not mentioned is how our policy in Syria is linked to U.S. energy policy, and that seems like an underrated subtext to this.
I'm very glad you asked that question, as military veteran Richard Nixon used to like to say. As we discussed, as a weak economy, they're very powerful in energy. Since the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union fell, there have been regular predictions that their economy is about to collapse. They have a very effective black market, a very effective old-time mafia, and collection of mafias, but they also have oil, which has been their ace in the hole. We are developing tremendous new petroleum and related resources thanks to fracking. And in thinking strategically, which we all hope our leaders are, this gives us tremendous leverage in the world.
This is the notion that taking action in Syria doesn't necessarily do anything to ensure the security of our energy supply.
It's not related. Well, Syria, of course, is not a major oil producer, but if the region goes up in flames and our Saudi friends are very active in trying to manipulate the situation in Syria. Another point not often discussed but important. We were haunted. We were really worried through the 70s and haunted until recently by the fact that we're dependent on overseas oil. Our politicians obsessively talked about that, especially when running for the White House. They don't talk about it much anymore because we're now a net exporter in gasoline. We soon will be a net exporter in oil generally, which we were until about 1960. This is a huge strategic change and means that we don't have to be as concerned about anyone in that region as we used to be.
It's all interesting food for thought, and I'm sure this is not the last we will talk about it.
Absolutely not. No, it's really important to focus on this.
Art Sear, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Art Sear is the Claussen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business and Director of the Claussen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha, and he's our foreign policy contributor. Keep listening after a break. Why a lack of sleep might have a significant impact on our bottom line, or at least our waistline. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. We hear two things just about all the time. Americans weigh too much and Americans don't get enough sleep. Well, while there is a lot that goes into both of those phenomena, it turns out that lack of sleep might contribute to our eating habits. That's the conclusion of a research study co-authored by Dr. Cecilia Hillard, a professor of pharmacology and director of the Neuroscience Research Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She explained to Lake Effect's Bonnie North what drove her and her fellow researchers to look at this question.
The story kind of starts maybe in the 1950s or 60s when surveys suggested that people in the United States would get somewhere between 8 and 9 hours of sleep every night, the average individual. And if we fast forward to 2010, that number's now dropped to less than 7 hours of sleep on average in each person. At the same time, we all know the numbers of obese individuals have gone up during that same time period. And epidemiologic studies can graph those two changes and show that there seems to be a relationship or a correlation between the loss of sleep and the growth of our midline. But like all epidemiologic studies, really all it can say is there seems to be a correlation, and it's difficult to prove that one is causing the other, right? So I collaborate with a wonderful investigator down at the University of Chicago, and her name is Ev Van Couter. And she's very interested in trying to understand whether there is a causative relationship between the loss of sleep and the obesity epidemic that's going on in the United States. So what she does is bring in healthy, usually male, young people who are lean into a structured environment in which she controls how much sleep they get every day, as well as isocaloric meals. In other words, she's feeding them the exact same amount at set times during the day. And then most importantly is controlling how much sleep they get every night. And so she can manipulate the length of time that these individuals are sleeping and then ask them the next day, how hungry are you? She can also measure things in the blood that we know are factors that are communicating between the gut and the adipose tissue and the brain that are sending signals saying, you're hungry, you better eat more, or the opposite signal, which says, you're really full, stop eating. So she has the ability to really ask the question whether or not this shortened period of sleep that we've experienced does increase hunger and therefore alter the motivation for us to consume calories.
So what is the answer?
The answer is they are very much related. So what happens when someone, even with as few as 2 or 3 days of a sleep deprivation period, which is generally about 4 hours of sleep is what she uses, they see a vast increase in the amount of hunger these people are experiencing the next day. And not only that, when they measure things that are in their blood that we know are factors that either cause us to eat more or to feel full, she sees a reduction in the factor that says you've had enough to eat and you're feeling full, and an increase in the concentration of the factor that says you need to go out and eat more food. So it's a bit of a double whammy when you consider those two things that act in opposite directions are both telling the brain and therefore telling you the next day that you're hungry and you need to eat more food.
So it sounds like our biology is working against us in the modern world, that we're set up to increase food consumption because the body is saying, oh, well, you know, I haven't had enough sleep. I need to have my energy restored somehow.
Exactly. You're right. So the body is perceiving you being active for a greater portion of your day as a need for more caloric or nutrient intake to support that activity. But as you alluded to, famine and starvation are more of a problem in our hard wiring of our body than overeating is. So the body is set up to overconsume calories whenever it's noticing a deficit in the amount of calories needed to keep the body going for that period of time. So you're absolutely right. What happens is that the body overconsumes. One estimate is that this loss of about 4 hours of sleep per night really costs the individual about 130 calories. I mean, that's just a piece of bread, essentially.
Not much.
Not much at all. But yet, the signals that the brain is receiving are to consume far more than just that little bit more. So we're overshooting in the consumption of additional food to cover this need for more energy.
It's almost like, again, the brain is thinking, well, it's short now. It might be short again tomorrow. It might be short again the next day. So we better get it now.
Exactly. We're saving up for that famine that may be coming ahead of us, and so that we have enough fuel and enough fat stored in our bodies to get through it.
What do we take now that we've seen the cause? There is a causality and that these two things are very intricately linked. Is it as simple as saying get more sleep to fix the problem?
It definitely, that's the first thing I think people should do. Anybody who is trying to fight a weight problem, who is not sleeping at least 7 hours a night, you know, and even better, 8 or 9 hours a night, that would be a very simple thing to try and fix. It would be very interesting to notice whether they felt less hungry if they really got themselves into a different sleep pattern.
But I can hear people saying, there just isn't possible to get more sleep. You know, I've got this obligation and that obligation, and the family is doing this, and this has to happen. How do we juggle that? How do we make that happen?
Yeah, I mean, that's the priority thing, right?
Yeah.
And deciding how you're going to spend your time. But just like needing to add more exercise into your day to make yourself healthy as well, I think that we are really underestimating in many ways the importance of sleep in our daily lives. And, you know, we focus on we got to get up early and get a run in so I'm more healthy. But if you're robbing yourself of an hour or two of sleep to do that run, you may not actually be going in the right direction.
So sleep might be more important.
It could be, yeah.
So are there – I know there were tests done in terms – you mentioned earlier the various hormones that make you feel hungry, make you feel full. What were specific findings in mm-hmm. this study? Were people literally losing their satiety hormone if they hadn't slept enough?
That's right. So their satiety hormone levels were going down and their orexigenic, or that hormone that's telling you I need to eat, is going up. So that was the finding that was published several years ago. And what her laboratory and my laboratory have done recently is actually identified yet a third factor that actually is an endogenous activator of the same receptor that's activated by marijuana and its chemicals. So we certainly all have heard, I'm sure, that cannabis use or marijuana use causes the munchies. And this is a real phenomenon. When cannabis is ingested by people, it activates a receptor that promotes eating of very highly, we call them palatable foods. Translate that into junk food.
Something that tastes really good and is really bad.
Exactly. Lots of sugar, lots of fat.
Not broccoli.
No. So when people are using marijuana, they have this phenomenon. Well, we know that there's a chemical in the body that we call the endocannabinoid, which is the brain's own marijuana, essentially. And what Dr. Van Couter's lab and my laboratory did together was actually measure the concentration of the endocannabinoid in the blood in these human subjects that were either getting normal amounts of sleep or shortened sleep. And what we found, first of all, very remarkably, is that the concentration of this compound in the blood varies almost fourfold from nighttime when you're sleeping and you shouldn't be eating to daytime when it's very high. So this fits the idea that this is another factor that's driving us to consume calories. And of course, we need to consume calories during the day. I mean, that's when we eat. And so it's very high during the day and off at night.
Are you saying that when people aren't getting enough sleep, that this particular receptor is higher when it shouldn't be?
So what happens, so in under normal conditions, it rises and peaks maybe at about noon, and then it comes down to virtually to fourfold less by the time you're going to bed. What happens when somebody's been sleep deprived is that it goes up higher and it peaks later in the day. So it's sort of driving, it's moving the whole timing of your consuming calories to later in the day. And anybody who's been trying to think about their weight and when they consume calories knows that there's some evidence that you should eat earlier in the day rather than, of course, right before you go to bed. That we kind of do it backwards in this country. We should be having breakfast as our largest meal and dinner as our smallest. So the dysregulation in this factor seems to be that it's prolonging this need to consume calories till a little bit later in the day, and then increasing the amount of it that's in the blood overall as well. So we need to sort out a lot of things, but if there is sort of a one-to-one relationship between the amount in the blood and how hungry we are, you can see that this is going to add to our problem of wanting to consume not only food, but junk food.
So it's not just a matter of willpower.
It's not. I'm a neuroscientist, so I firmly believe that the way we work and the way we make our decisions and so forth are regulated by chemical changes in our brain. And this is just another example of a very sophisticated process that is designed to keep us from starving, that in 21st century America is getting all out of whack and is really pushing us to gain weight.
So what's next for you in terms of further study? What are you going to be looking at on the back of this?
Mm-hmm. So one of the things we still have to do, so in addition to the measurements of these chemicals in the blood, we also have survey information. So the people were asked, how hungry are you, et cetera. So we need to fold all that together and sort of see whether there are relationships between the concentrations of these endocannabinoids in the blood and how hungry people are. And then secondly, I think we start thinking about interventions. You know, are there ways that we can modulate this driver for consuming a lot of high calories? So, for example, what is the overlay of exercise, for one thing? So if you exercise early in the morning, does that help mitigate the effects of this hormone that's driving us to eat? Is it the same in males and females, which is another really important question? Is it the same during the period of people's lives? That relationship between loss of sleep and weight gain is actually more profound in children even than in adults. So is this system really dysregulated more in children? What happens on the other end of the age spectrum after menopause, for example?
Or, you know, older people almost always say that their sleep has changed.
Yes.
That they don't sleep as much.
Right.
For whatever reasons those are. And I would imagine that that would have something to do with it as well.
Right. Although the elderly tend to not respond to that with a lot of weight gain. So is there something that happens ultimately that maybe breaks the relationship between loss of sleep and this increase in caloric intake?
Well, as you get ready to do all of that and find those particular results, I guess the best thing we can do is say, get more sleep.
Yes. What your mother told you, sleep and exercise and drinking a lot of water, those are still probably the best messages for a healthy life.
Well, Cecilia, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today. It's been very eye-opening.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it very much.
Dr. Cecilia Hillard is a professor of pharmacology and the director of the Neuroscience Research Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She's co-author of a study on lack of sleep and eating. The results were presented over the summer at the annual meeting of the Endocrine Society. Another break now, then a fall movie preview with film contributor Dave Lurson. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Keep listening. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. The fall movie season has a distinctly different feel than what just came before, the summer movie season, and it also feels a lot different than the holiday blockbuster season that's still to come this year. Film contributor Dave Lurson joins our Dan Harmon to give us a peek into what will soon be coming to a theater near you.
After a summer dominated by Dumb and Dumber movies, many of them underperforming at the box office, fall offers relief to filmgoers starved for something smarter. Fall is also the season when bets start being made for Oscar contenders, given the Motion Picture Academy's notoriously short memory when it comes to movies released before Labor Day.
And there's plenty of offerings that are not Oscar contenders, but we will only discuss those if we have time later. But,
right.
So are there some broad categories of Oscar contenders as usual, historical pieces or fantasy pieces, whatever?
It's almost weighed a little bit more toward one or two kinds of things than normal this year. There are 10 contenders that I've identified, and all but two of them, I believe, are based on true stories. Most of those are set either in the distant past or the recent past. There is one contender based on an award-winning stage play, and only one that's an original screenplay that's not drawn from some historical episode.
And which one is that?
That is Gravity, the George Clooney, Sandra Bullock astronaut movie about a problem as they're orbiting the Earth.
Sounds pretty. I don't know, average on paper when you describe it like that. So why is that an Oscar contender? Just because of the performances?
Performances, hopefully, the cast. George Clooney is a popular man around Hollywood. So he attaches his name to something, there'll be some attention to it. And I don't mean to make it sound banal. We haven't had a good astronauts lost in space movie for quite a while, I don't think.
At least a year.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't mean to make it sound banal and boring. On paper, it doesn't sound like all that.
Well, it depends, I think, really on the performances of the two protagonists in this movie and how they deal with the catastrophe that faces them.
Can I just get the Hunger Games out of the way?
Right.
I'm not a big fan, but you say there might be some potential good performances in that.
Well, you know, the actress in that movie has gotten a lot of attention, Jennifer Lawrence, as the it girl of the second decade of the 21st century, basically. She's a very capable, talented person, seems to have both feet on the ground. The Hunger Games is a cultural phenomenon. The books were not maybe quite on the sales level of Harry Potter, but they are up there. They evidently have been quite inspirational to a lot of younger people. The first movie did well. The second movie will no doubt do well, and I will predict that she will be nominated for Best Actress.
Okay. You know we're taping this, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. The Wolf of Wall Street, Leonardo DiCaprio, latest
well,
one?
Well, it's his fifth collaboration with Martin Scorsese. Those two really get along well together. This is one of those historical, based on a true story films, of which there are so many this fall. It's based on Jordan Belfort's memoir. He was a corrupt New York stockbroker, convicted of securities fraud. Leo enacts his story.
All right. And there's two that I caught me by surprise when we were talking about this beforehand. Thor, The Dark World, you think has some potential, and Ender's Game.
Well, not Oscar potential, but right. Both of them will probably do well at the box office. Thor was one of the big blockbuster films of a couple of summers ago. And Ender's Game has gotten a lot of publicity, not all of it positive, based on opinions of the author of the book. But the book was enormously popular in science fiction circles. The movie will probably do okay, at least, and maybe quite well.
And two more that I'm just not that familiar with, August and Captain Phillips.
Well, August, Osage County, that film.
Right.
It's Harvey Weinstein is behind that as one of the producers. It is a award-winning stage play, a Tony and a Pulitzer Prize. Julia Roberts and Meryl Streep star in it. It's a family, problem, drama, comedy, a married couple. One of them is an alcoholic. The other comes down with cancer. So it's got lots of potential to pull the heartstrings while not being too dire.
And what about Captain Phillips?
Captain Phillips, another based on a true story from recent history. It is Tom Hanks playing Captain Phillips, captain skipper of a cargo ship hijacked by Somali pirates. So we have Tom Hanks at sea and not confronted with a volleyball, as in one of his famous movies from about 10 years ago, but faced with the real possibility of death at the hands of pirates.
Is this the first movie about being captured by Somali pirates? I don't recall there being any others.
I believe it is, and it naturally the theme has potential. I mean, it's there used to be a lot of pirate movies back in the day.
Yeah.
And probably 20 years ago, if somebody had said, piracy would be on the rise again, we would have laughed at that. But it became a serious problem. Apparently, the increased naval patrols in the Indian Ocean have begun to turn the tide against the Somali pirates. But certainly, this was grabbing a great many headlines a few years ago. Europeans and Americans and other, people from around the world were being taken captive, held for ransom. So you can just see the dramatic possibilities here, why this would interest Hollywood.
The latest Benedict Cumberbatch movie, are you suggesting that he might be someone that is award-worthy, or the movie itself?
Well, he's actually in a couple of movies. The one that maybe is most striking is The Fifth Estate, also based on a true story.
Uh-huh.
Set in recent historical times. It's based on the memoir by a disgruntled co-founder of WikiLeaks. Julian Assange has already condemned it sight unseen as being a propaganda assault upon him. Benedict Cumberbatch has already been quoted as saying he's not afraid that his bank accounts are going to be wiped out by angry WikiLeaks supporters because he has his own army of online people who will cover his back.
Oh, boy. All right. So this
there'll be war in cyberspace over this one.
Well, is this movie going to be more of a phenomenon, or do you think it actually is some kind of Oscar contender?
No, I think it's an Oscar contender. Cumberbatch is, again, one of these rising figures. He was not put to particularly good use, I don't think, in the Star Trek movie that came out last summer. But he first caught my attention in the British TV series Sherlock, where he plays this kind of contemporary, highly eccentric Sherlock Holmes roaming the streets of London. He was superb in that, and I see him as having enormous potential.
All right. Well, Tom Hanks shows up again in something with Emma Thompson, Saving Mr. Banks.
Saving Mr. Banks, yeah. Based on a true story and set in the past, actually, and set in 1964. I'm looking forward to this because it has to do with the production of the first movie I ever saw in a movie theater, Mary Poppins.
Oh.
And the time of its release. Emma Thompson plays the Mary Poppins author, P.L. Travers. Tom Hanks plays Walt Disney. And as far as I can tell, there was some conflict between the two over how to interpret her work.
And George Clooney, Matt Damon in The Monuments Men.
The Monuments Men, based on a true story set in the past, has to do with a true-life Allied raid into Nazi-occupied Europe during the tail end of World War II to rescue an enormous cache of artwork stolen by the Nazis. You know, the Nazis, the leading figures, were art lovers in their way, and they helped themselves to the museums of France and other countries that they occupied. And naturally, there was a great effort on the part of the U.S. and the Allies to secure these things before they could be destroyed or sold on the black market or otherwise vanish.
Is The Secret Life of Walter Mitty based on a true story?
It's a remake. You know, 1947 Danny Kaye film with Ben Stiller. It's kind of interesting that they would choose this. That was a very funny movie. Danny Kaye was one of the great comedians, and probably Ben Stiller maybe is trying to model himself after this, or maybe Danny Kaye was a childhood inspiration to him. I'm not sure what the thinking was behind this, and I don't think that too many people younger than me are familiar with the original. Unless you're an avid TCM viewer, and maybe you've seen it. So for most people who actually go out to movie theaters, multiplexes, and opening weekend, it'll be a whole new concept.
Do you think Ben Stiller, in this case, is going to get serious about comedy, if you can put it that way? Because he does have kind of a typecast, I would say, where it's a little more schlocky and mm-hmm. just kind of fun-oriented. Is this a step up for him, do you think?
Well, it could be. If my theory behind the motivation of this is correct, I think he would want to fill those Danny Kaye shoes.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think that he has a future ahead of him. He's done well at the box office many times, and he probably will be one of the forces in comedy, and if you give him better material, I think he'll be quite good.
And there's a movie about Mandela. Is that something you think is going to be an Oscar contender or just something really worth seeing?
Hopefully it'll be worth seeing. It should be interesting. Oscar contender, it's not being talked about as such at the moment, but it could be, given the enormous acclaim of Nelson Mandela. He has been, lingering in the news because of his health condition. So people have not forgotten about him. He was a pivotal figure in 20th century history, right up there with Martin Luther King and dealing with, highly charged racial issues. So there you would think would be a great built-in audience. And among the Academy members who like to reward serious movies about serious topics, It has some traction, I think.
Well, speaking of serious stuff, I wanted to ask you about Carrie, mm-hmm. the movie Carrie, which is it a remake of a remake? Or is I seem to remember it being remade.
I believe that there was a TV movie here. I mean, there are those of us who would say we should pause a live interview and go to the IMDb and take a look and find out right away. But mm-hmm. I think there was something after the 1970s classic Sissy Spacek movie. Sissy Spacek was in her late 20s when she played that part. The actress in the upcoming Carrie is actually age appropriate.
Okay,
so that's being used as a selling point.
I seem to remember another horror movie being remade not too long ago. And are they just running out of horror ideas? Why do we have to remake a classic, if you will?
Well, why remake anything that has a familiar title? I mean, a lot of people have heard of Carrie, whether they've seen the original movie or not, but somehow it's out there. And maybe there are these remakes that people have seen. People are sort of familiar with it. And Hollywood's mentality has been for a long time, put a familiar name out there and people will come. It doesn't always work.
Didn't work for Footloose.
Didn't work for Footloose. We could name countless examples. Bewitched, the movie. Mr. Ed, the movie. I mean, a whole plethora of popular 60s TV programs made into movies that flopped. But yet they persist in this because they have an apparent fear of new or original ideas.
All right, Dave, lots to see this fall. Thank you for coming back on.
Thank you.
Dave Larson is arts and entertainment editor for the Shepherd Express Weekly and author of its I Hate Hollywood column. He's also our monthly film contributor, and he talked with Dan Harmon. One last break, and in just a moment, why Detroit? Detroit might be worth your next road trip. Detroit, even as some are quick to write it off. Keep listening. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Travelers Roundtable correspondent Rob Bundy joins us once again. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good to be back.
Rob is taking us to, Detroit, a city that has spent a lot of time in the spotlight over the past summer, and not necessarily for such great reasons. I don't know that Detroit is first and foremost on most people's vacation radar.
Yeah, well, certainly not if you believe most mainstream media reports, no.
There was the bankruptcy filing in July.
Yeah, and it set off an international flurry of doomsaying for the 11th time. Yeah, so that's that. Detroit is just finished. Again, it's over.
Again.
Well, yeah, I mean, excuse my being a little exasperated, but it's far from the first time the pundits have given Detroit its last rites. The eulogies for Detroit have come steadily for years. Every news cycle, there's a new reason why death is imminent. Stories of the city's epic rise and fall. It's practically a literary subcategory. Documentary films, coffee table books filled with intriguing ruins that are beautiful and heartbreaking, and the message that everything's always just getting worse.
Well, so then if that is the dominant narrative about Detroit, what is the subtext?
There's all kinds of great things happening in Detroit, but much of the media finds the good bits, shall we say, inconvenient. It's like the media has this lovely eulogy written, and Detroit just keeps ruining everything by refusing to stay dead.
This is like the Monty Python sketch where they're telling them to bring out your dead and the one guy insisting that I'm not dead.
Yeah, shut up. You'll be stone dead in a moment. the media just won't let go of its fond narrative that all is lost for Detroit, and then people, whether they've been to Detroit or not, just parrot that narrative. So the good things, and there's a lot of them, tend to get ignored or treated as outliers and dismissed.
Just to play devil's advocate here, Detroit is not the same place that it was in its heyday.
Oh, no, fair enough. Look, you don't have to look very far to find ruined buildings, sure. But there's also so much that is new and wonderful. There's too much greatness that still remains there and a great deal to interest the visitor. But the national media just will not. Here's just one example. In July of this year, shortly after the bankruptcy was declared, Wired magazine published this big, beautiful photo study by a genuinely gifted Canadian photographer. 10 photographs, and it was all the majestic ruins of Detroit. They were artfully done. 10 of the images in the slideshow were of the 1926 Book Cadillac Hotel. And the photos were so sad of the poor, poor, abandoned Book Cadillac Hotel. But, you know, 5 of the 10 pictures in that study were buildings that had already been restored back to their original glory, including the Book Cadillac Hotel, which was restored more than 5 years ago to the tune of $200 million. And I was there. I swam in the pool. I ate at the 3 new restaurants. It's fantastic. And it's a good symbol of Detroit's indomitable spirit. It bounced back from the crash of 1929, and it's bounced back again in a big way. But according to Wired magazine, it's all still ruins. And I'm not the only one who likes Detroit, by the way. On the last night of our stay, I got out of the elevator at the Book Cadillac as Anthony Bourdain was getting on.
And so did you compare notes with Anthony Bourdain?
Oh, I was a total fan. Not ashamed to say I gushed. I took his picture with my wife. He was really nice. I was so surprised when I saw him. I blurted out a bad word, and he leaned down and told my 5-year-old son, every time he swears, he has to give you a dollar. He was a very nice man.
But to make a long story short, you are not the only travel writer that is caught on to the pleasures of Detroit.
More people are starting to question the doom and gloom storyline. I really look forward to hearing Anthony Bourdain's segment on it.
All right. So as a visitor to the city, aside from the Book Cadillac Hotel, what were your impressions and how were they different than what we're hearing?
We loved Detroit. I'll admit it. Those stories of doom are powerful. I'd only been once on business many years ago, saw nothing of the city, was uncertain. But the people who actually live in Detroit, as well as many of the frequent visitors, say it's a great city still. And especially over the past couple of years, it's getting better all the time. You walk through the downtown area, you'll see dozens of building permits, sold signs, new construction. Local developers are buying up dozens of properties right in the downtown area. Maybe they don't want anybody to know because they want them all for themselves. One example, last year, three vintage 20-story high-rises in the downtown area were completely renovated into high-end condominiums, and all three of them sold out within weeks. They didn't have enough. People wanted more. Energy is pouring back into Detroit, and the people are moving back too because they want to be part of that emerging scene.
I'm not sure, though, for the average visitor, condominiums are an amazing draw. What are the draws for the traveler coming
to Detroit? Okay, fair enough. You want to enjoy some of the world's finest art, beautiful parks, magnificent architecture, stunning museums with singular collections, evocative and interesting restaurants, great craft bars, artisanal craft and indefatigable creativity, and people that are friendly and welcoming. You really need to visit Detroit because you're going to have a wonderful time. Detroit has problems, sure. There are 40 square miles of vacant space in the city of Detroit. That's a fact. But the people who choose to live there, and there are more of them every day, are writing upon those blank pages, and they're creating new chapters. Detroit has a new Riverwalk that's almost completed. Not quite, but it's open and functional. It's a big hit with families. You'll see wonderful architecture. There's urban gardens that were empty lots not too long ago. There's great new places to eat in Greektown. Newly restored buildings in the theater district. You've got night spots like Cliff Bell's Jazz Club, a short walk from the Books Hotel's door. Comerica Park, home of the Detroit Tigers, is only a half dozen blocks away.
You can catch up on Prince Fielder's home run hitting while eating a delicious Coney dog.
Ah, the Coney dog. Yeah. And some of the reinvention in the city has just been plain fun. The Detroit Institute of Art is one of the top 10 art museums in the country and worth the drive from Milwaukee all by itself. I'm serious. They have a glorious collection that includes Renoir, Degas, Van Gogh, an important American collection, and a trove of Dutch masterpieces. And maybe what they're most famous for, they have this astonishing Diego Rivera mural that wraps around all four walls of this central atrium. It's just breathtakingly beautiful. The museum also has a brand-new, remodeled, three-story, glass-ceiling Kresge court, more impressive than ever. They have a sculpture garden. If it's Friday in the summertime, head into the courtyard and hear live music. And after you hit the Detroit Art Institute, you definitely need to pay a visit to Rodin, just opened this year. Great restaurant. You've got to go to Green Dot Stables in Corktown. That's a new restaurant where they have gourmet sliders, each with a recommended Michigan craft beer pairing. What did I have? We had the fried chicken slider with panko, sage, maple syrup, paired with an Atwater Brewery's Ghetto Blaster, the venison hot dog with the urban truffle fries. They have a mystery meat slider that changes depending on what unusual creature they can get their hands on. I missed the chance to eat a camel slider by days. I'm heartbroken. all the sandwiches are like $2 or $3 a pop. We loved it. Look, many of these are new places, and they are well worth seeking out. Oh, another thing. One of my favorite parts of the trip was a tour with the Art House Lectures and Tours hosted by Professor Michael Farrell, and that was a blast. Michael is like the favorite professor you had in college, warm, brilliant, funny, and an encyclopedic knowledge of his subject. And he and Art House manager Mark Herrick can put together a tour custom tailored to your interests.
And so what do you see on this tour?
Wow. Well, they showed me the incredible Fisher Building, one of the finest extant examples of Art Deco in the country. I also saw Wirt Rowland's Guardian Building, an exuberant downtown combination of Art Moderne and Native American influences.
This seems like an unlikely combination.
No, trust me, it works. It's actually my favorite building in Detroit and out of a crowded field. Farrell's a great raconteur, very entertaining and really informative. I learned the stories behind the buildings, why they mattered, beyond what I could see with my own eyes. Oh, you got to check out their own house, their art house. It's a stunner, magnificent house. And while I was there and marveling at the craftsmanship, Michael pointed out that there were holes drilled into the doors for deadbolts that were installed when the place was down at the Heels boarding house in the 70s.
They're not patching them?
You see, yeah, that's what I asked Michael. And when I did, he turned to me with this look of theatrical surprise and said, "Why? The holes are part of the history."
That's a pretty good way to look at it. Maybe a metaphor for Detroit.
Yeah. And I learned to see all of Detroit through that lens during the rest of my stay. The flaws, the old wounds, the gaps, they're part of the city's history.
This sounds like a pretty full itinerary for Detroit.
Oh, yeah. And there was so much more we left on the table. We can't wait to go back.
All right. Without further ado, Rob Bundy reading an excerpt from his travel essay, Redefining Detroit.
At 5:45 a.m. on the morning of my last day in Detroit, I groggily emerge onto the street outside the Westin Book Cadillac Hotel. I love cities in the dawn light before they become populated for the day. Everyone is towing up under the starting blocks. Expectation, potential, what might be possible in a day. As I wait for the light to change, I hear him before I see him. A smiling man walks toward the heart of downtown, singing at the top of his lungs. He's dressed for work, work somewhere, with an apron, black pants, white shirt, and gleaming black shoes. His arms are pumping as he walks, and occasionally he punches the air to emphasize a line in the song. He's on his way with enthusiasm, and he's got a song sending him there. There goes Detroit, I think, singing on its way to work again. Nothing's open this early on a Sunday, nothing except the world-famous American Coney Island, a Detroit institution open 24 hours a day and only one block away. Two guys in paper hats are working the place, a young industrious guy barely out of his teens paired with a white-haired veteran. Both welcome me in and ask me what they can do for me. I look up at the menu on the wall and confess that I'm a first-timer, so I suppose I should opt for the holy article. The older guy laughs and asks me if I want tomatoes, chili, onions, ketchup, and mustard. I ask him if I do, and he says, yeah, I do. So I do. What he presents me with is so iconically American it should be on the money. A hot dog and a white bread bun in a paper cradle with the works. I find a chair and set my breakfast down on a plastic laminate counter to briefly consider this simple thing that everyone in Detroit thinks they personally own. At Rodin, my wife and I had chatted with a local couple over shared small plates, and at one point I had asked the man about the fabled Coney dog. It's just a hot dog, right? I said. I mean, all hyperbole aside, it's just a hot dog. And he had laughed, perhaps a bit self-deprecatingly, and he owned that, yeah, it's probably just a hot dog. But the way he said it, it was as if he was admitting that the Labrador he'd grown up with was just a pet, or that his father or his grandfather was just a guy. What particular thing we choose as a community to identify with at the end of the day doesn't really matter. It could be anything. A hot dog, a well-made watch or bike, the way we like our pizza, a company, or the fond gathering places where we see our friends and drink together. Why, it could even be something as trivial as a square of brightly colored cloth that we hang from our porches on summer holidays. Whatever it is, it's us. It's who we are. It's our neighborhood, our little place on earth. The humble thing becomes the signifier that we use to declare ourselves to the universe. And in the end, it doesn't really matter what we rally around, so long as we rally. And Detroit is rallying and reinventing and reincarnating into something worth visiting again. It's going on right now, right as you listen to this. But as cool as it is, even the locals can't really define it for you. You'll have to do that for yourself. Why don't you?
Rob Bundy reading his travel essay on Detroit. Rob, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Rob Bundy is our Travelers Roundtable contributor. He writes about travel for Third Coast Daily, and you can find his essay on Detroit at wuwm.com/lake effect. That's another week's worth of Lake Effects, produced by Dan Harmon, Stephanie Lecce, and Bonnie North, with Amy Kiley and the assistance of Eleanor Peterson, Nathan Royster, and studio engineer John Strelecki. You'll find lots to do this weekend around southeastern Wisconsin. I hope you get to enjoy some of it at least, and also include us in your plans. Lake Effect Weekend airs Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 right here on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock. Have a great weekend.